Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, it's Mondays with the Mayor. Marty Walsh is here to talk his plans for 2020.
We are a city that rejects racism and bigotry in all its forms. We are a city that stands for social, economic, and environmental justice. We're a city that welcomes and supports immigrants. We're a city that leads the fight for gender equality, LGBTQ equality, disability rights, veterans' rights, and a strong middle class. That's who we are in Boston.
We'll take your calls and questions. And the Supreme Court declines to hear an appeal in the Michelle Carter texting suicide case. What does that mean for freedom of speech?
The fact is that when you're talking about words that are ambiguous and suicide, whose causes are ambiguous, you shouldn't be using the criminal law for these purposes.
Plus, the 10th anniversary of a devastating earthquake in Haiti and the way the community mobilized to help people affected. It's next on WBUR's Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Monday and time for our monthly Mondays with the Mayor. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh is with us again in Studio 3 for one of his regular check-ins. Good to see you again, Mr. Mayor.
It's great to be here.
We want you to join us, too. It's a great time to talk with the Mayor. If you have questions for him, give us a ring. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So I want to save the bulk of our time today, Mr. Mayor, for the big agenda items from your State of the City address. But first, yesterday was the 10th anniversary of the devastating earthquake in Haiti. We're going to hear from some voices on that here on the show later in the hour. But you know, it left more than 200,000 people dead, more than a million people displaced, a very large Haitian diaspora here in our greater Boston community. How are you reflecting on it?
The night of the earthquake, I thought to myself, 2 years prior to that, I was in Haiti with Marie St. Fleur. And we were in Port-au-Prince, went up to Capetian, went around the country in different places. And
she was a state rep at the time.
She was a state rep at the time. And I thought to myself, they were showing a picture of Port-au-Prince, kind of the center of the town. But I knew the devastation beyond Port-au-Prince was terrible because the conditions were difficult when I was there. Some places didn't have roads. Most of the houses were huts. And just hearing about that, the loss of life was just unbelievable. And after that, you know, I worked with Marie and sending some supplies to Haiti. And then my time with the building trades, I actually got the building trades to partner with Jim and Sarah to build a hospital and get doors and workers and talents down to Haiti to build a hospital that was somewhat earthquake proof. I've been watching on TV this week the celebration of Brittany Life, Built Like Brittany, a young woman who wanted to start an orphanage down in Haiti. It was just such a sad time, and the city still is. You know, the Haitian people are hardworking. We have the third largest Haitian diaspora in the country here in Boston. Thinking back, first of all, just thinking about the devastation, and they haven't recovered. You can't recover from that, but Haiti was having difficult times before that with infrastructure, and hopefully we can all support the Haitian people in that and moving forward. But
by next January, some 50,000 Haitian immigrants to the U.S. could face deportation when their temporary protected status (TPS) expires. How will that impact folks here in Boston if that happens?
Well, let me just explain to people that are listening that might not be for the temporary protective status. Haiti in 2007, when I was there, had very few jobs. The average wage, I think, a week might have been $5. Families living in huts, you know, cinder block huts in some cases, and basically very, very, you know, tarp huts in others. The situation has not gotten better. The folks that are here are adding to our economy. They're sending kids to our schools. They're working hard in jobs that in some cases people wouldn't fill. If you talk to anyone in the Haitian community, they're very hard workers, very faithful religious people as well. And I'm hoping that the federal government can figure that out, and understanding that, you know, sending 50,000 people back to Haiti is just going to cause a bigger humanitarian issue in Haiti. The American government, I'm not sure exactly today how much we're were involved. But when I was there in 2007, the UN was there. We were very active. The World Bank was there. We were very active in the humanitarian efforts there. And I think that, you know, I don't think it makes sense to end the status here. Many of those family members now have kids that are going to our schools, were born here in this country. They're American, and now to send them back to a situation that is still not that's still not where they need to be, Haiti. And I think that I would hope that the next administration actually puts more effort into Haiti to strengthen the country and help the country to get back on track. I mean, they're amazing people. You know, when I went there, just the experience I had, I went there with several legislators and business people. The experience I had in Haiti was just it was life changing in some cases. And you know, Marie St. Flour knows that. And, you know, Marie St. Flour is the first Haitian-born person to be elected to any legislature in the country. Linda Dosina Fori served in the legislature. Her family's immigrants. She's from first generation. So I just think that I hope that we can the American government can understand the importance of this.
Let's talk about another community important in Boston. What are your thoughts for the Puerto Rican community as they reel from more tremors after the earthquake?
It's amazing. You know, after they had the hurricane, we got together as a community with the leaders in the Puerto Rican community and raised money, I think $2 million to send to Puerto Rico. Back when the hurricane happened, we sent police officers down there, majority Puerto Rican police officers down to Puerto Rico to help establish some more being out there patrolling the community, patrolling the neighborhood. Then the earthquakes have happened. You know, we've had the one earthquake and then now the tremors. It's awful, sad, devastating to what's happening there as well. And the Puerto Rican community in Boston as well. I think we might be the third largest Puerto Rican community in the country here in Boston as well. And what people don't always understand, Puerto Ricans are Americans. You know, they're American people. And I think that we have to understand that. And any support that we can give the Puerto Rican community would be great. You know, right after the hurricane, I had a chance to go to Caguas with Alex Cora, the general manager of the Red Sox. He was brand new at the time. And, you know, it was just amazing being there. People came from miles around to get food and water that was brought down by Sam Kennedy and the Red Sox and Alex Cora. And being part of that was really amazing as well. And now to understand the devastation again, I mean, it's a lot for any area to take that much devastation in literally a two-year period.
Our lines are almost full already with callers, so let's talk to a caller. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To talk with Mayor Marty Walsh. Brendan's on the line from Somerville. Brendan, go ahead.
Hi, guys. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hi, Brendan.
Hey, so I've heard a lot of celebrities like Joaquin Phoenix talking about the climate change issue, and I was wondering, Mayor Marty, do you think the salary that you pay your girlfriend could help with some of that kind of stuff?
Brendan, it's great to talk to you today. I'm glad that you started the call off in such a positive manner. I thought you were going to ask me about climate change and what we're doing in the city of Boston on climate change. And if you take a little time to research that side of it, it'd be great to see it happen. Basically, we lead the country when it comes to climate resiliency, which I don't know if you know that, if you did your background on that. I'm a member of C40. It's mayors from around the world. I'm on the executive committee, and I was in Copenhagen a few months ago talking about climate resiliency and climate goals and what we're doing in our climate. We have Renew Boston Trust and a whole bunch of other things. So if you want to talk about climate, Brendan, please call me anytime. If you want to take a cheap shot, being on the radio is probably not the best way to do it. Have a great day.
Let's take a different call. We've got Fred on the line from Waltham. Fred, go ahead.
Hello, Mayor Walsh. I'm concerned about the tea and what's going on within the 128 area. There is talk in Boston in the city council to make the tea free and look into that. And I'm wondering if that's something that you would promote. And because of keeping
Fred, your line quality is really poor, so I'm going to take it back from you there and give the mayor a chance to answer the first part of your question about a free tea.
Thanks, Fred. I think actually the first part of your question, Fred, I'm assuming your comment was about how we need a more dependable service that moves forward and some consistency there. And I know that there's been some investments made by the state, and there needs to be more. I called the other night in my state of the city for bolder transportation investments, of looking at raising real big revenue to make investments in the T. I think the T has a couple different issues. Number one is we have a ridership that seems to be declining a little bit. Partly is because of the service. Number Two, we have an infrastructure issue that we have to resolve. And number three, we need to make bold investments. Now, having a free tea sounds like, in theory, a brilliant idea, and in theory it is. The issue is, how do we pay for it? And I think that you might be referring to some proposals actually started in out in Kansas City, where the city council voted to make their service free for bus service. In Massachusetts, the mayor of Lawrence, Will Antigua, Dan Rivera, that was a slip, was...
I think he's going to forgive you.
I hope he forgives me, because I serve with the former rep, but Dan Rivera is a great guy, and what he's able to do is take $224,000 and make investments to have a pilot program for three lines in the city of Lawrence running free bus service. We're looking at Boston, how much that would cost. We're talking probably tens of millions of dollars to have free bus service in the city of Boston. And the issue I think we have to have a real conversation about is revenue, and how do we make up for the lost revenue there if we make it free? And number two, I think, which is really number one, making bold investments in the service to bring it all up, not just the buses, but the trains and the commuter rail.
All right, let's stay on this subject, actually, and we'll move into State of the City now. You addressed three really big priorities in that speech, housing, education, and transit and transportation. So let's stay with that, since we got a call on transit in the first place. And let's remind our listeners of just a taste of what you said.
And I'm calling once again for the city of Boston to have a seat on the MBTA board. Our city and our residents are the largest taxpayers into the MBTA. This is Boston, and we've never been big fans of taxation without representation. You deserve a voice.
Crowd got a pretty big kick out of that. We noticed that Governor Baker was sitting right in the front row. Were you talking to him? Was that a message to the governor?
No, I was talking. Well, in that particular case, I was talking to the state that I think that Boston should have a seat on the MBTA board. We had one in the past, 2010, when the Transportation Reform Act came out. Boston lost its seat on the board. I voted against that act as a legislator. It was a merging of then Mass Highway, the Mass Pike, and the MBTA kind of into the super agency. I voted against it because I didn't see the savings. Fast forward many years later, there's been no real savings. It's even costing more. So my concerns back then have come through fruition now. So I'm asking for that board seat. We're the largest single payer in the MBTA, roughly about $90 million per year. We have the largest ridership, either originates in Boston or comes into Boston every day. And I think that having a seat on the board is important for that, for us.
You called on the state legislature to allow Boston to vote for bond measures that have allowed cities like Los Angeles, Phoenix to, quote, take a quantum leap forward in transportation, end quote, through major infrastructure projects. Short of action from Beacon Hill, and they've been light on transit action, how much as mayor of the city can you do when a lot of the problems are state level, and how are you thinking about that?
Well, we have to work together. I think that in fairness to the legislature and the governor's office, they've taken some actions, but I think they need to be bolder. I think that we can't be. This isn't a renovation that we need to do in the MBTA. This is almost a reconstruction of the MBTA in a lot of ways, whether it's new lines, signalization, expanding the platforms, having more continuous service on the trains, whether it's in town or in the commuter rail. When you think about our economy, we've gone through a great economy here in Boston the last 6 years, a little longer than that maybe. The state's had 4 years of great economy. If we want to continue to move our economy forward, move our people forward, they need a first-class transit system. There are people listening to us right now on this radio that are stuck in traffic, that are frustrated, that I think if they felt the trains and the buses could be quicker and faster and move on time, they would abandon their cars and go on the trains.
I got to ask you about that, abandoning cars. The Globe did a report on the very small percentage of legislators, public leaders who take the T.
That's not a fair assessment right there. You're talking 200 people. I mean, we're talking, that's not a fair assessment.
Well, but about you? Do you drive?
I get driven around in the city. I have a car. One of the things that I think that's an easy kind of low-hanging fruit. I mean, we should look at the greater issue is, how do we get a system that works across the board? I can't really justify why I have a car, but today I was at six different things in the last 4 hours and bouncing around. But I think that if there was a system on the greater the greater system, the bigger part of the system. I think that, that's something that people are asking for. I mean, that story the Globe wrote, I mean, that usually gets recycled once every 4 or 5 years and the story comes out.
If you were going to characterize the collective voice of the constituents of the city and how they feel about transportation and transit right now, what would you...
They're not happy. They're not happy. I mean, I hear it every day. I mentioned it the other night at the State of the City that, you know, people, I hear it every day all the time, frustration of whether it's traffic, the way that blocking the box and some of the other things that happen on the driving side of it, and the lack of consistency on the trains and the buses. And that's why I think when I called for that action the other day, I mean, we're doing some of it ourselves. We're creating more dedicated bus lanes in the city, and we're going to continue more of that in 2020. You know, we're asking the legislature and the governor to be bold as far as investments in transit. And what I ask for, if that doesn't happen, give us the opportunity in cities and towns to be able to vote on ballot initiatives and go out and explain to the voters of Boston and other cities and towns why a larger investment is needed. L.A. County went out to the ballot and got the voters, 72% of the voters voted to increase an assessment on their sales tax, which is going to raise $120 billion to do major investments in the transit system. In Phoenix, in Mesa, in Tempe, Arizona, the voters voted to fund a light rail system to connect those three cities. And so it's happening all over the country. I think that we really have to look at this and make major investments.
Let's take a call on this. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John is calling from Winchester. Go ahead, John.
Hi, Mr. Mayor. How are you?
Good.
I was just wondering, I was calling about bike lanes, and, you know, I don't want to really get into the danger zone, but I'm wondering if maybe you could use some of that money that you're pumping into LB strategies, the slush fund that you employ your girlfriend.
Callers, listeners, I apologize. I don't know why we've got a second call like that, Mr. Mayor. I apologize to you, but let's talk about bike lanes.
Just for John's, I don't know what you're talking about, slush funds, John. So I wish all the callers who are on the line here calling have a little decency. If you want to talk about the issues of, if you're telling the caller, the screeners in the back, that it's about bike lanes and climate change, those are serious issues that actually listeners want to hear. They don't want to hear you guys taking cheap shots again.
Yeah.
So bike, as far as bike lanes, we're making investments. Just if John is concerned about bike lanes, he's in Winchester, so I'm not sure if he is. But if he is concerned about bike lanes, again, in the capital budget last year, we looked at some investments as far as parking fines and doubling parking fines and all the money that we're creating there. We're actually, ironically, the last two callers, we're investing it back into infrastructure. Bike lanes are part of that, and environmental issues as well and projects.
So we're going to take a quick break, but before we do, it was a beautiful weekend this last weekend. Warm days on Saturday and Sunday. Did you get a chance to enjoy that weather at all?
It was. I'm not sure if John and Brendan enjoyed the nice weather this weekend, but I certainly did. It was nice. No, it was nice. We had some events, but it was beautiful. At least having 2 days of 70-plus degree weather in the middle of January, which is amazing.
It does kind of cheer you up.
It does.
Yeah. All right, so we're going to take a short break. I hope you'll stick around
for
when we come back. Listeners, stick around. Call in with real solid policy questions for Mayor Marty Walsh at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and still with us here in Studio 3 for our monthly check-in is Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. We are talking about the Mayor's State of the City address from last week and three key issues. We did transportation before the break. Let's talk about housing now, and let's remind listeners some of what you said on housing.
Rents and home prices are stabilizing, but they're still too high for too many people. There's much more work to be done. So tonight, I'm announcing an unprecedented investment, $500 million over 5 years to create thousands of homes all across our city, affordable to a range of incomes from our most vulnerable to the middle class.
All right, so $500 million of investment. Let's get to specifics. How would it work and what would the money go to?
Okay, the first part of that is a $100 million investment that we'd make in the budget, which basically doubles our capital budget. So that money, $100 million, comes from the city coffers, and it's over 5 years, $20 million increase a year. The second piece of that is selling the Lafayette Garage, which is downtown. It's a garage that we operate in the city. There'd be an opportunity for us to receive $100 plus million for the sale of that. you know, it generates minimal revenue today. There's been some interest in people looking to buy that garage. You cannot, it's not a situation with Winthrop Square where people built a building on top of it. This is, they wouldn't be able to do that. That money would be invested back into public housing. We'd be able to move projects along like Mary Ellen McCormick and other places and also make investments in senior housing. The figure of renovating our senior housing developments in the city of Boston is roughly $30 million, and I'd want to renovate every single senior housing. They haven't been renovated since they've been built. The third component is a transfer tax up to 2% on any sale of any property over $2 million in the city. It would generate, or percent roughly generates, it would cost roughly on a sale of $2 million, roughly $24 million, $24,000,
yeah.
Excuse me, $12,000 by the seller, $12,000 by the buyer.
And the state would have to approve that.
The state has to approve,
right?
That one. And basically, what we're asking the legislature to do there is give us the ability for the 2% transfer tax up to 2%. It is not a tax vote for the legislature, it's an approval to allow the city of Boston to impose that fee. So, any elected official that's taking a vote to increase taxes or fees in that particular case would be the city council and the mayor's office. And that would generate roughly 100, if you do 2%, $130 million. If you do 1%, $65 million. And that would be a yearly investment that we could put into housing. That's an important one.
We've got a call. You want to
be
up for this?
Yeah.
All right. We've got a call on housing, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ken from Alston, go ahead.
Yes. Hi, Mayor Walsh. Thank you for taking my call. I had a quick question about your thoughts regarding rent control or discussions around rent control coming back into Boston.
Yep.
I think he's just looking for your thoughts.
Oh, my thoughts. Okay. I think that, you know, there's many different forms of rent control going on, conversations around the country. I actually filed a bill that would deal with working for seniors over 75 years old, basically limiting the ability that their rent can be raised. It's a form of rent control. I think everything is on the table for conversation.
You know, rent control was outlined, essentially ruled out at the state level in 1994. How much would it require state cooperation to put into form any kind of rent control?
Well, it does, but it's not just simply rent control. Rent control is not the only situation here. The problem that we're seeing in Boston is a supply and demand question. The demand is too high and we don't have enough supply. I mean, we can have all the rent control measures we want. We're still going to have a supply and demand issue. And I think that's something that we have to figure out here. I mean, Boston's grown, population's grown. 50,000 people in the last 6 years. We're close to, if we're not over 700,000 people living in the city of Boston. You know, 30 years ago, we were at 562,000 people. The housing plan that we created calls for 69,000 units of new housing by 2030, which will increase our population about 760,000 people. So it's a question of supply and demand right now.
So if you think about sort of, I'm going to date myself, an old graphic equalizer, right?
In school, yes.
You dial it up and dial it down. When you think about new building versus controlling rents versus new funding, for example, your voucher program, the citywide voucher program that you proposed, what's the balance of that? Like, you know, how much do you think it's new construction versus subsidies versus controlling rents in existing environments?
It's all of it. It's all of it. You can't, it's hard to really describe it. I mean, new construction is needed. To create more opportunities, to build more housing. You know, the housing units of years ago, you'd have, when our population was 700,000 in the past, you had a family of five, family of six, family of seven, family of eight living in that unit of that apartment, if you will, in a three-decker. Today, you're talking about one and two people living there. The family unit is a lot smaller. I think the average family has 1.5 kids or something like that. So the family unit is smaller. So there's going to be need for more housing stock. And that's what we're experiencing in Boston. That's what they're experiencing in L.A. and Chicago and New York and all over the country. It's not just a unique Boston problem. It's a national problem. And this, you know, within the next, you know, decade or so, I think the numbers could be wrong, but I think it's roughly 90% of the American population are going to live in urban areas. So there's this move from the suburbs into urban areas. So when you see that type of growth happening, you know, what's happening is people that have the ability, the means, they're pushing people that don't have the means to be able to afford to buy a home or live in an apartment out. So there has to be a balance there. And I think as we think move forward here, it really is about putting more supply in. Our focus in what we talked about the other day at the State of the City, what I spoke about, was not high-end housing. My focus is on middle-class, low-income housing, making sure we continue to create it. the reason for the housing voucher program is
to talk a little more about
is to allow
program.
Poor families to be able to stay in the city of Boston. We're able to get some additional revenue from HUD, from the federal government. Last year, we had 1,000 housing vouchers. But we also need the help from cities and towns around the Commonwealth to help us with housing. I mean, we can't be the only city building low-income housing. And that's if you look at a graph of the housing that's been built and low-income housing been built in the last 10 years, Boston, it goes off the chart. And you
what
know,
do you mean by that goes off the
meaning
chart?
Meaning the amount of housing that's been built in Boston, low-income housing built in Boston compared to any other city or town in Massachusetts. That's a problem.
I'm sorry. I think I just want to clarify what you're saying. You said that the amount of low-income housing being built has gone off the chart, and that's a problem,
yeah,
or am I misunderstanding?
No, you're misunderstanding me.
Okay.
That other cities and towns aren't building it.
Got it.
So plenty of cities and towns and people or advocates are talking about building low-income housing, but they're not building
but
in their
not
community.
Doing it.
So we need them to build in their community. They're not even living up to the 10% affordable number. You know, there's a bill the governor has at the State House called Housing Choice. You know, it doesn't appear that that bill is going to move forward. That does not affect Boston, but what it does, it affects the way that cities and towns vote on projects, that they would just need a simple majority rather than the 2/3. You know, we can't – everyone focuses on Boston when it comes to low-income housing, which is important, and I'm a big proponent of low-income housing. But other cities and towns need to help us here. It can't all be built in Boston.
You know, stepping out of housing for a second but staying with this other cities and towns, as I was listening to your State of the City, I was thinking – I don't know what was true 50 years ago, but today it seems like to be a mayor of a city like Boston, you have to have significant regional influence because so many of the challenges that you're talking about are partly affected by decisions made in the city, but also partly affected by regional balances, yeah. Housing, transportation, climate, yeah. Which we thought we were going to talk about at the beginning. How do you think about your relationship, your influence, your negotiating in the region when you're trying to tackle these complex issues?
I mean, I work very closely with my colleagues in the Metro Mayors Coalition. That's not always been the case in Boston. In the past, Boston worked in a silo, and I am very pro working with other cities and towns. And I've said this multiple times that, you know, whether it's a transportation project or an environmental justice project or an economic development situation, I will work with any city and town to help them continue to grow their city and town. We don't need it all in Boston, and I don't think that should be the way. I think we have to work regionally. We're living in a regional world, regional economy, and what happens in Boston impacts Pittsfield and Holyoke, and what happens in Pittsfield and Holyoke impacts Boston, and we need to continue collectively work together to make sure that all of our cities and towns are being successful.
Let's take a call on real estate. We've got John calling from Mansfield. John, go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. I read an article, I think it was the Wall Street Journal in October. They published something regarding New York passed a law stating the limited liability companies had disclosed who the owners of real estate were, like mainly condos. And I wonder if that's something we would look into doing, especially with all the growth in sales in the seaport, for instance.
Okay, thanks, John.
Yeah, I'm not familiar, John, with that. I have to check into that. I'm not sure what the law states today here in Massachusetts. I'd have to look into that. I don't even want to make something up here for you. Let me look into that, John, and see what the story is there.
So in the meantime, there's a
hearing. I hear what John's trying to get to is the point of these shell companies coming and buying property and sitting on them and not knowing what's happening, who they are. What's I'm assuming that's what he's talking about. So
in principle, how do you feel about that?
We want to make sure it's who owns the companies.
So there's a hearing on Beacon Hill tomorrow on some of the housing issues. Are you going to be there, and what do you plan to argue before the state's lawmakers?
No, I'm not planning on being there tomorrow, but I was already up there. I was up there a couple weeks ago on zoning requirements and some of the other legislative matters. And Chairman Honan of the Housing Committee was able to move some legislation out and get it to the next level. So we've been staying close contact with Chairman Honan on the House side, just because all of these have big implications in some cases for Boston. When I say big implications, small implications that add up to a big change. And I think we have to continue to move forward.
We're having Mondays with the mayor, with Mayor Marty Walsh. We're about to shift gears and talk about education. If you've got a question for the mayor on education, give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. In the State of the City last week, you praised the legislature for passing new education funding, but you said that is not enough for Boston.
Over the next 3 years, we'll provide $100 million in new revenue for direct classroom funding. This level of planned
This level of planned new investment over and above the cost increases has never been done before. It will reach every school and be carefully targeted so every dollar makes a difference.
So tell me about this carefully targeted. What are you going to target?
This is $100 million that we're going to invest in the school. That's direct classroom funding, which means that it's not going to teacher contracts. It's not going to keep the lights on and all the bills that you pay. Right now, the superintendent, Brenda Casilius, is working with the school committee to come up with where they're going to make those investments and what areas and what programming and what schools. We're going to be targeting underperforming schools that we have in the city of Boston, roughly about 31 underperforming schools that we want to particularly target. And then look at where the other investments go, target investments. We want to make sure, I mean, just to sum it up pretty briefly, when a third grader graduates third grade, they need to be reading at third grade level. For too long, our kids have been moving along the system. We also have some of our kids have serious challenges in our district. We have 4,500 of our 57,000 kids that are homeless. We have situations with English is not their first language, with mental health services, with poverty, all of the different situations we have in our district that we're working with our kids and our families. And we have to make sure that their families have the supports they need as well.
What's your greatest sense of urgency around education in the Boston public schools right now?
I think it really is, you know, making sure that we're treating the family. I mean, there's so many different systems set up that too many families are falling through the cracks. And what happens is those families that are having struggles and challenges, their children end up in our district. And so as we have the kids in the classroom, you know, the 6 or 7, 8 hours that we have them in the school, that's fine. But the kids spend the majority of the time, 16 hours a day, not in our classrooms. And you know, how do we help those families? And I think that having a better consistency of services is important. Now, we can't do it all in the city. The state does a lot of that. But we're looking at how are we more consistent. One of the responses we did last year, we put nurses in every school. We had nurses kind of covering 2 and 3 different schools. We're still in the process of hiring those nurses. We've added more counselors in our schools to deal with our young people, the challenges they have in our district, but also working with the families. We're looking at that, more inclusion in our schools. There's a whole host of issues. I mean, it's not a simple solution. I mean, and I think we have to continue to not just make investments, but come up with policies and procedures and how we move forward. You know, educating young people is complicated, and there's plenty of people that have opinions on it that like to constantly just criticize the school system, but they don't take the time to actually learn of the challenges that our kids have. I just left the Horace Mann School for the hard of hearing in our city. 80 kids, they're amazing kids in our school, and I was talking to the young people in there about some of the things that they'd like to see in the school, and they explained a whole bunch of new technology they'd like to see in the classroom and helping our kids. And then when I had a chance to talk to the parents, and not the parents, but the leadership, you know, those kids are experiencing some poverty in some cases as well. So in a lot of cases, we have to do, as a society, we have to do a better job. This isn't just simply having the kids in the classroom. This is a societal issue.
So I want to pull in some comments from others who listened to the speech. City Councilor Andrea Campbell put out a response on the education part afterward and suggested that there wasn't enough vision. There wasn't enough of a plan there. Respond to that.
You know, I'm willing to work with the counselor on anything to make our city better. Again, the vision is Brenda Casilius, and I think I was very clear that night. Brenda Casilius and the school committee are working right now on a plan on where that $100 million goes into. You know, Councilor Campbell has a lot of emotion about the school. She has 2 young children, and you know, obviously a lot of passion, and I love that, and I think we need more passion when it comes to our schools. We need to make more investments in our schools as well, and I think that, you know, the last 3 years last 6 years more money in our system than any other time before. You know, these are very challenging, complex issues that we have in our schools that we're dealing with.
I think you know that last week WBUR reported that Boston Public Schools resource officers were filing reports that went into BRIC, and the Lawyers for Civil Rights revealed that more than 100 of those reports containing students' personal data became available to federal immigration officials since 2014 after submitting them into the BRIC. You just passed a new Trust Act in December. What was your response to that? And what's the right balance?
I'm not sure if the information was passed over to immigration on that.
They have access to
that claim.
The BRIC.
So I have to, I'm not sure if that's accurate. We had a meeting today. I had a meeting today in my office to get to the bottom of the process and the filing and moving forward. in something that when I heard that, I mean, if this story has been going on for a while now. It's been going on for since, I think, 2017, something very concerning to me. You know, we passed the Trust Act. The city council passed it, and I signed it into law at the end of the year about data sharing and information sharing, what the police have. You know, it's been told to me that the school department does not share any information on immigration status with the Boston Police Department. So that's something that we've been talking about. And I'm hopeful in the next couple of weeks we're going to have a process. We actually updated our process in 2018 with sharing information and how we move information forward. So as we move forward here, I want to get more answers to questions that I have myself before we make a full statement on what we're going to do. On the other side of that, there is information that we need to make sure that they're shared with the police department that keep people safe. Gang activity, guns, drugs, different issues, situations that we have in the school department. We want to make sure that if there's a threat at all to any of our schools, any of our kids, by any of our kids or our schools, we're going to check that threat to make sure that's not a real threat. I mean, I think there's too many cases in America where there was kind of vague threats made and they didn't follow up, and we ended up with very tragic situations. I have to make sure we protect our kids as well.
Okay, let's try to get one more caller voice in. We've got Donna on the line from Brockton. Donna, go ahead.
Hi, Ms. Mayor, and I'm glad I'm still part of the cusp of the education conversation, because I also had a question about that.
Just pick one question, Donna. We've only got a little time.
Okay, well, the EL students, as you said, make up a large portion of the Boston Public Schools, and it's continued to increase as well. And a lot of these schools, students attend public schools. They don't attend the charter schools. And overwhelmingly, the charter school students are white and don't have ELL students in them. So it seems, and then also...
Donna, I'm sorry, we are running out of time. So let me just give the mayor a chance to say something about English language learners in our schools. We've got only about a minute left.
Yeah, and Donna, just so you know, in Boston Public Schools, I don't control the charter schools. I only control Boston Public Schools. And we have a lot of amazing ELL students in our schools. And some of that money, that the new investments that we're going to be making, are going to be definitely focused on ELL students in our schools.
One quick question, 20, 30 seconds. You talked a lot about the opioid addiction crisis in your last State of the City. I didn't hear it in this year's. Why wasn't it there again this year?
No, it was there. I mean, Kenny Evans, one of the people that spoke, but I mean, it's there. I mean, it's front and center. The problem is you have a limited amount of time to be able to talk about issues, and it's broadcast on TV, and so that the issue is what can make the speech, what can't make the speech. We did something different this year as well by putting four people speaking before me that did an amazing job, and so it's a limited amount of time. There's always how much time we can focus on the issues that are at hand. I mean, there's a whole bunch of issues. We could talk more about criminal justice. We could talk more about the climate environment. We could talk more about a lot of things, but unfortunately, we didn't have the time. Just like right now, I'm being cut
That's
off.
That's right. Good thing it's not the only time you get to talk. Yeah. So I'm looking forward to having you back next month. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, thanks so much. We do look forward to seeing you next time.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Dearing. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. Today, the Supreme Court declined to take up an appeal filed by Michelle Carter of Plainville. Her boyfriend, Conrad Roy, killed himself in 2014, and Carter was convicted of involuntary manslaughter for encouraging him to do so. Her team said that the conviction violated Carter's First Amendment rights. Our WBUR legal analyst, Nancy Gertner, is part of that defense team. She's also a retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. We caught up with her earlier this afternoon, and I started by asking her for her reaction to the Supreme Court declining to hear Carter's case.
I'm saddened by that. I think that this is a really critical issue. It's not just a First Amendment issue, not the right to say anything you want anywhere. It was the use of the criminal process, the criminal law, to make criminal words that she said, particularly in a situation where those words supposedly led to someone's suicide. This is not the kind of situation where you're talking about encouraging someone on the phone to, you know, why don't you go kill X and go to this place and do it this way. This is using words to cause a suicide when the issue of causation is complex, as we see in this case and in the BC case, and when the issue of what those words were is complex. And we were asking the Supreme Court to resolve whether words could be used in this fashion.
Okay, we'll come back to the BC case at the end. Why do you think the justices, given everything you just said, why do you think the justices chose not to hear this appeal?
Well, they have had a pretty busy docket coming up. I think it's a question of they don't necessarily turn down cases that are not meritorious. They pick and choose what they wish to opine on. And this just wasn't up there with, abortion and issues with respect to the president. So it doesn't necessarily mean anything about the merits. We're going to be seeing this over and over again. It's going to get to the Supreme Court one way or the other at some point, and that will be very troubling.
Does that mean that it's essentially – my assumption was that with the Supreme Court not hearing it, that means that the lower court's findings essentially for now represent settled law. Are you saying that that's not the case?
Lower court's findings for now represent settled law. I expect that the lawyers in the case of the woman who supposedly encouraged her boyfriend to commit suicide from BC, Boston College, that they'll be raising some of the same issues. I expect that if there is another prosecution anywhere in the country, they will raise the same issues because the issues are not insubstantial. You know, the question, suicide is a complicated decision. And when someone is just using words to encourage someone else to commit suicide, not facilitating, not providing the drugs, not providing the weapon, the question is whether or not you want to use the criminal law in that way. What are the limits of the criminal law?
Let's talk about this use of words for a minute. You just referenced the Boston College case with In Young Yoo, who faces an involuntary manslaughter charge after she was accused of berating her boyfriend, Alexander Ortula, to the extent that he essentially committed suicide. Much of the case in the Carter situation hinged on a 47-minute phone call between Michelle Carter and Conrad Roy after he got out of a truck in a shopping mall parking lot. But the phone call wasn't recorded. Do you think there was enough discussion during the trial about whether or not that conversation happened as Carter said it did?
There's no question that there wasn't enough conversation about that. We got into the case after the trial, and we were stunned to find out that the words that everyone was repeating over and over again, the get back in the truck statement that Michelle Carter supposedly made to her boyfriend, that was not in any contemporaneous text. That was not in any overheard conversation. That was her recounting it 2 months later in a rambling text message with a friend of hers. That didn't come out. Just as in the BC case, for every get back in the truck comment, there is a please, Conrad, don't do it comment, which just points up how complex these cases are. I mean, the best way to describe it is this is both speech on the one hand, this is suicide, which is incredibly complex. The causes of suicide are incredibly complex. And these are adolescents saying all sorts of stuff on the phone. And the notion you can wrap that into a criminal package and throw someone in jail for it, it seems to me is preposterous.
So there's a very long record of texts between In Young Yoo and Alexander Ortula in that case. There is some record of the exchanges between Michelle Carter and Conrad Roy as well. That seemed to be enough for a series of courts to determine that she had committed involuntary manslaughter. Why is that not convincing enough to you?
The fact that courts have been convinced to find this involuntary manslaughter, that's not convincing to me. I was a court once. I'm happy to criticize courts. It seems to me that the Supreme Judicial Court made a grievous error in this case, and I think that the Supreme Court made a grievous error in turning it down. I think that we're going to be seeing these cases over and over again. And finally, in my judgment, some court will say there have to be limits. Facilitating suicide, standing next to, providing the means, you know, is one thing, but just words is quite another thing.
As you noted, you were the court, right? You were a federal judge. You
also,
That's right. And you noted that you got involved in this case sort of later after the conviction, but you chose to get involved. Why does this case bother you so much?
I care about the use of the criminal law in ways that can hurt people. In other words, the overuse of the criminal law. When you talk about using words, particularly adolescent words on text messages, means that any prosecutor can make the decision to pursue this as a manslaughter. And once the law is that vague, once the sort of mix of words that you're going to say count as manslaughter is as vague as this, then that is open for arbitrariness and open for misuse. That's the problem here. To the prosecutor in Norfolk County, this may look like manslaughter. To the prosecutor in Suffolk, it may not. If there is no press, that may mean there is no manslaughter conviction. Who knows? The fact is that when you're talking about words that are ambiguous and suicide, whose causes are ambiguous, you shouldn't be using the criminal law for these purposes.
All right. So what happens next for the Michelle Carter case?
Well, I think we have to talk. I mean, I think that this is certainly a bad sign. I'm someone who never gave up and never gives up, but we're going to have to talk. Certainly, this is the end of the line for this round. There's no question about it.
Nancy Gertner, WBUR legal analyst, retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and serving on Michelle Carter's defense team. Thanks for joining us on Radio Boston today.
Thank you.
And if you or someone you know is struggling, you can reach the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. It's 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. Or the Samaritan's statewide hotline at 1-877-870-HOPE. We want to reflect for a few minutes now. 10 years ago tonight, the cathedral in Boston was full. Members of Greater Boston's Haitian community, Boston city officials, state senators and representatives, members of the Commonwealth's U.S. congressional delegation, and area clergy and community leaders gathered to be present together in grief, anger, and worry. It was the night after a magnitude 7.0 earthquake hit Haiti. At least 220,000 people died, 300,000 were injured, and more than 1 million people were displaced. Greater Boston has the third largest Haitian diaspora in the U.S. That first 24 hours, those with family in Haiti walked in a nightmare. Who survived? Who was injured? And what would come next? As president of Catholic Charities at the time, I was one of dozens of nonprofit leaders, public officials, community activists, and volunteers who were gathered by then-Mayor Tom Menino for a coordinated response, emergency assistance, outreach to people at home, medical care, legal aid, and bringing survivors to the greater Boston area. Esteline Bruno is one of those survivors. She lives in Brockton and moved to the United States in 2010 because of the earthquake.
Listen, in Haiti, after the earthquake, my work was collapsed. My house, we lost everything we worked hard to get it for many years. We lost it in 1 minute.
She says she had no choice but to seek a better life in the United States for her and her three sons.
There's no work there. There's no way to sleep. We sleep in the street. We slept for many days there. And then, you know, there's no food, there's no way to go to see the doctor, there's no way to restart in Haiti.
She says she took English classes and had assistance from Catholic Charities. Now she's in nursing school.
Sometimes, you know, in your mind, you never forget your country. I had a good life there. But this country, you know, you try to make it, but it's not easy. But we make it.
Her son, Sten Bruno, barely remembers the earthquake. He was only 8 years old at that time, but he says he's thankful for the opportunities he's been afforded growing up in America. He plays football and is in his first year of college.
I took this opportunity and, like, made myself into a football player, made new friends and do new things. And it's not all for certain because any day it could, like, go away.
Esteline and Sten are two of 5,000 Haitians in Massachusetts under Temporary Protected Status, or the TPS program. The Trump administration tried to end TPS for Haitians 2 years ago, but it was extended until 2021 due to pending court decisions. What happens next year is weighing on them.
I've spent more than, like, half my life here. It's not right that we don't know if our future here is certain.
The family sends money to relatives in Haiti, but haven't ever traveled back to the island. 10 years after the earthquake, the nation has been experiencing public protests, calling on the president to resign. People there are facing fuel and electricity shortages, and the cost of living is going up. Michel DeGraff studies Haiti at MIT, where he runs the MIT Haiti Initiative. He still visits the island and says one of the biggest needs is for nation building across class and language divisions.
So there's a Haitian proverb that says, wash the l'eau, pas qu'on doule, wash the soleil, meaning that the rock in the cool river, in the water of the cool river, doesn't understand the pain of the rock that's drying up in the burning sun. And this has to change. We have to go beyond being rocks. We have to be human beings that can have empathy, solidarity, and transcendence across social classes and use our common assets like our language and our culture to build a nation that's politically strong, that's socioeconomically strong.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.